This week on Potlatch, Fairbanks lawyer Barry Jackson tells about his suit to recover money for services rendered in the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement. Mossy Davidson from Homer, Alaska, and Changes. Barry Jackson says a fund of $1.9 million set arbitrarily by Congress shortchanged the 40 or so lawyers who worked on the land claims bill. He charged that Congress made no effort to evaluate the lawyers' services. He doubts it would be practical to solve the problem by new legislation or by adding another amendment to the Land Claims Act. Tlingit lawyer Fred Paul, who first filed a claim, is now representing Jackson's case. Under the Tucker Act, attorneys had to file within 6 years of the passage of the Land Claims Act to receive any right to sue. Jackson believes that for various reasons no other lawyers will file claims. He says that he incurred up to $25,000 in out-of-pocket expenses for which the federal government reimbursed him just $15,000. That amount, plus the $100,000 award by the federal government, amounts to $115,000 already awarded to Jackson. Jackson estimates his services as up to $500,000 in value. But he's not asking for any specific amount in his lawsuit. Jackson now tells the history of his involvement in the land claims settlement.
Well, I became involved in 1965. I was a lawyer in private practice in Fairbanks. I was practicing alone. I had been city attorney of Fairbanks for about 3.5 years. And one day, several natives from the village of Minto came into my office, leaders, together with William Byler, who was the executive officer of the Association on American Indian Affairs in New York, which is a nationwide group interested in Indian affairs. It does lobbying and other activities. And they asked me if I would consider representing the village of Minto. Minto had been faced with the fact that the state was selecting the Minto lands, the Minto flats, and a protest to this state selection had been filed by Ted Stevens when he had been in private practice in Fairbanks earlier. But Ted was no longer available, and they were looking for counsel. I indicated that I would take it on after some discussion, and I began representing Minto at that time. At the very beginning, since I was, frankly, without much in the way of funds of my own, the association agreed to pay my fees at that time on a current basis out of current funds. As time went on, I picked up additional clients. The second one was the Nenana Native Council. And then I picked up a number of other villages. And I continued work. I began getting involved with the Tanana chiefs, and Tom Fenton, who had been the district attorney in Fairbanks, went into private practice and joined me as a partner, and we became attorneys to the Tanana chiefs. Tom was also quite interested in the effort. He, in 1967, the work began getting fairly heavy, and the association was no longer able to cover all of my fees, and we decided that I would enter into normal contracts that, land claims contracts, which require approval by the Secretary of Interior. There is a law on the books which says that there can be no attorney paid for services rendered to an Indian tribe unless it's under a contract which has been approved by the Secretary of Interior. After some time, we developed a contract which had been suggested by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or at least the Washington level of the Secretary's office. We had to revise it because the standard contract contemplates simply a suit in the Indian Claims Commission or the Court of Claims for compensation for lost land. And we were beginning to think in terms of trying to keep the land for the people. And there was some question as to what forum that would be in, possibly in the Court of Claims, with the power of the court to award land as well as money. Action against the state of Alaska, possibly some relief from the state legislature, possibly relief from the Congress. So we revised the contracts, and after some difficulty, did get three approved contracts with Minto, Nenana, and Tanacross. At about this time, we began representing the Tanana Chiefs Conference, but the secretary had ruled that an association, a regional association, was not a tribe, and therefore a contract with a regional association did not require the approval of the secretary. Fred Paul had secured such a contract from the Arctic Slope Native Association, and it had been approved by the secretary, but then the secretary subsequently rescinded his approval of the contract on the basis that it was not necessary. As we went along, we picked up additional village clients, and we submitted contracts that were identical to the three approved contracts to the secretary, and they were disapproved. And we were advised that a change would be necessary, and they submitted an additional form of contract to us. The first contracts we had called for an equitable fee for the work that we performed. An equitable fee, but not to exceed 10% of what was awarded. And furthermore, the equitable fee would be set by the Secretary of Interior after it was all over. Exactly what is an equitable fee? Well, in terms of law, it is what is fair. Matters that are taken into consideration in determining an equitable fee include the time the degree of expertise required, the benefits received by the client, the ability of the attorney to take on other cases, or whether he is prevented from taking on other cases because he has the particular case in question. There are many factors that go into determining what is an equitable fee. When we were turned down on the next three contracts on the basis of an equitable fee, we were suggested that an appropriate formula would be quantum merit. Quantum merit simply means the value of what the service is it was rendered, but without any limit, without any 10% limit. I felt that a quantum merit basis was the same thing as an equitable fee, and while I was perfectly willing to have a 10% limit, or even a lower limit for that matter, I was a little surprised that the Secretary's office thought that that would be appropriate. We began running into a concept that we were really not acting as attorneys. What we were doing was simply acting as lobbyists. And as a lobbyist, we should not get an attorney's fee on an equitable basis. The Secretary's office was saying, in effect, that really, gentlemen, all you're doing is what we in the Secretary's office have a duty to do anyway. It is our job to represent the natives before Congress. We have a trust relationship with them. We are going to see that they are properly taken care of. And what you're doing is not going to amount to all that much. Well, the fact of the matter was that the Secretary's office was thinking in terms of 1 million acres of land and perhaps $7 million total for all the natives of Alaska. And by late 1967, we were thinking in terms of 60 million acres, and we were thinking in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars as being appropriate. And there was a very clear conflict of interest, because we were suing, in effect, the United States to keep title to land or acquire title to land and quite a bit of money, and yet that was in the control of the Secretary. At any rate, we were then prepared to enter into three contracts on quantum merit. Within a week or two of receiving those form of contracts, we received a wire from the Secretaries saying that the whole subject of attorney's fee contracts was under review within the Secretary's office, and that all other contracts that we might have would be disapproved, and we would be advised of, in the future, of what would be an appropriate form of contract. In fact, we were never so advised, and we continued to work, frankly, trusting in Congress to provide for an adequate and reasonable and equitable fee for the attorneys who were involved. I was representing by this time also the Alaska Federation of Natives, and I worked for them for about a year. I continued to invest money as well as time and talent in the effort, and I was fortunate to have available to me at that time funds which my first wife had inherited. And they came through in about 1968-69, and we invested those funds in the effort, and by the time we were through, she had loaned me about $90,000. That enabled us to continue the work, and we did a very heavy level of effort in 67, 68, 69, 70, and 71. But all really, frankly, without any assurance that we would be paid, except that I did have the three approved contracts. Well, come down to the final days, and there has been no testimony, really, in the proceedings before either the Senate or the House on the work that's been done by the attorneys, the value of the work done by the attorneys. And the Senate and the House essentially arbitrarily established figures for payment of all of the attorneys who were involved, which involved something over 40 attorneys, involved approximately 30 law firms, and involved something on the order of 40,000 hours of work, which in attorney's time, an attorney can't charge for an 8-hour day. He has to charge for the time he actually works. And that probably represents about 40 man years of effort. The bill also provided that the existing contracts, including my approved contracts, would not be enforceable, that we could not enforce them, and that we would be relegated to a fund which eventually turned out to be $1.9 million for compensation of all counsel. Now, that presented a very serious problem. Some attorneys had come in fairly late in the game when it was clear there was going to be a bill, and their responsibility and their efforts were fairly narrow, specifically for their particular clients, say, in some cases. Whereas the attorneys who had been involved from the very beginning had frankly contributed a tremendous amount of talent and ability. And it was not just myself, there were other attorneys involved. Each of us among the Alaskan attorneys, in a sense, had their own special field of competence and expertise. And we contributed, in a sense, a team effort. I remember that Cliff Grove, for example, of Anchorage, was very influential in the Republican Party. He had close ties to Governor and later Secretary Hickel. Those ties also reached into the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce and into the Republican Party statewide. And his influence in those areas was very helpful to the Native movement. Stan McCutcheon, his partner, had similar ties in the Democratic Party. Plus, they had some funds which were made available to them through the Native Village of Tyonek, which they had represented, and which they had secured quite a few million dollars for. And they also had a major role in what I would call the organization effort among the Native people. They were influential in getting the regional association started. The Arctic Slope Native Association, they were not involved with. That was really started by the Association on American Indian Affairs, which also got the Tanana Chiefs Conference started about 1964. The other associations, many of them, were effectively started by McCutcheon and Groh. Fred Paul, who was a Seattle attorney but a Tlingit Indian, who represented the Arctic Slope Native Association, and he had certain special talents. For one thing, being an Indian, he could say certain things that a white attorney might not be able to when it came to talking to Congress or the state legislature or whatever. His father, William Paul Sr., had been involved in the Native Land Claims Movement from the very beginning, about 1919. A very old man, an attorney, also in Seattle, and he had a tremendous background in the law of Native claims and was very influential. Those two were very influential in convincing other attorneys, not so much among us who were working on it, but other attorneys with the state and the federal government, that there was a valid claim and that it had to be faced up to. My own particular field of contribution was, in a sense, being an architect. I conceived of the idea that the natives ought to be able to select the land they would retain, rather than having the Secretary of Interior say, this is going to be your reservation. I thought of the idea of having regional corporations that would be in business, village corporations. The enrollment process, stock, the tax exemption system, many of the features like this. And this was a very innovative settlement, frankly. Now, every architect has to have a client. And our clients were the Native leaders, and they took my ideas and the ideas of some other attorneys and put them together, accepted some, rejected others. But essentially, the Native leadership, with my assistance and some other attorneys, developed the basic pattern of the land claim settlement, and we then proceeded to sell it to Congress and the administration. Well, the attorneys who had been in from the beginning, frankly, deserved more compensation for what they had done. Those who came in at the tail end certainly deserved fair compensation, too, but the standard might be somewhat different. The difficulty was that there was only $1.9 million available, and if the total amount of approved fees exceeded $1.9 million, then we would be reduced pro rata across the board, and whatever was available out of 1.9, that's what we would get. So we were also put in the unfortunate circumstance of having, in a sense, to fight each other. In other words, I did a better job than you did, you really fouled up over here, and therefore you shouldn't get as much money. The attorneys recognized this from the beginning as they put in their claims, and with some exceptions, did not fight among themselves. There were a few claims submitted that most of the other attorneys who'd been in the beginning recognized were poor claims, and we did file some opposition to those attorney fee claims. And generally they were either disallowed or allowed at a very reduced rate. But we were faced with years of litigation coming up, which would frankly have eaten up the attorney's fees that would be awarded. The attorneys eventually got together and agreed as to how we would split the pot, as it were. And in the settlement agreement among all of those who would receive funds, we accepted the figure of $130,000, which, mind you, is not income in the usual sense. It's not salary. This is what you pay your rent, your secretaries, everything else that's involved in operating a law office out of, and hopefully if there's something left, you take that home, and that's income. The $130,000 was frankly not adequate compensation. This was recognized by Congress when they passed the bill. One congressman on the floor of Congress in debate said it was niggardly. Another one said that it was the lowest attorney's fees ever provided for by the United States in any matter in which the United States had ever been, or perhaps anybody. Why? Well, there were some attorneys involved in the effort that gave the Congress pause. But generally, it reflected, I think, a prejudice against attorneys and an unwillingness to recognize the value of the services they perform in our society. In addition to that, some members of Congress were not very happy that we had given the Indians, the natives of Alaska, these ideas, and felt that really, if it hadn't been for the attorneys, they could have gotten off with a lot less in terms of what they would have had to pay to the natives of Alaska. They couldn't take it from them. They had to face the need for an equitable settlement with the native people of Alaska, and they did. But I think they took off on the attorneys as a result.
I have a beautiful, maybe. I like my little finger. If she get up, I mean, if she cut, I left her. My little finger. I'm going to sing about little finger after big finger. Thumb.
Yeah.
Charlie Panagoniak. Barry Jackson believes the Treasury Department should be the agency to reimburse him. He does not believe the money should come out of the settlement land claims money for any particular Native organization he represented, because his work helped to bring a settlement for all Alaska Natives. I asked Jackson how Native leaders reacted to his lawsuits.
I would say that I've been encouraged. I have spoken with a number of Native leaders, especially those that were deeply involved with me at the time, specifically Emil Noddy, for example, who was AFN president for a good part of this period, and Don Wright, who was the president of AFN and who did an absolutely fantastic job of manipulating the political process in Washington, D.C. at the end, and I assisted him in that. But he was the decision maker. I've spoken with him also. They both advised me that they would testify when I called them as to the scope of work that I performed and the value of the work I performed, as well as the other factors, which also do go into a question of an appropriate fee, a reasonable fee, and that is what were the burdens that I had to carry because of my representation of the Native movement. And I've talked with other Native leaders as well. I am the chairman of the board of the Thunder Times. When I decided that I was going to file suit, I made disclosure to the board of the Thunder Times and offered to resign. The board, at least as of this moment, has decided they don't want me to. I sent copies of the complaints to one other Native client that I represent, and their executive committee has decided they want me to continue to represent them. Now, that may change in the future. I'd have no way of telling. But at least initially, I have not been verbally attacked, and the leaders that I have known over the years, who I regard as friends, welcome me in their presence.
I ask if the money he is suing for would come from the land claim settlement money that went to Native corporations.
It is possible that the courts will hold that I do have some right to get some compensation from the Alaska Native Fund. If so, then the way I see it, it will reduce by a minute amount the assets received by each Alaska Native.
That was the Barrow Dancers. This is Jeff Kennedy, and thanks for listening to Potlatch.
Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.
From the University of Alaska, this has been a KUAC production.